On a Thursday, welcome on into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. How do you feel about our intro music, Cherry? It's for some reason, it's not hitting me anymore.
You used to like it.
I don't know. Maybe back to the drawing board of the intro music.
Okay.
Bookmark that for another day.
Uh-huh.
It's often said that we most fear what we don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
So when I see a scary headline about someone doing something nefarious sounding with tech and privacy.
Yes.
I'll admit,
scared.
I get scared.
Mm-hmm.
I get fearful. And seeing a lot of those headlines recently about DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. This is
mm-hmm.
Elon Musk's attempt to make the government run better. They seem to have access to all sorts of information, exactly what they have access to and what they're doing with that information and how personal it is and how much it could be an invasion of your privacy. Kind of hard to tell.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk about it today with a reporter who knows probably more about this topic than almost anyone on the planet, Charlie Warzel from The Atlantic. And we ask you, what do you think about DOGE potentially having access to your private data? Do you have questions about DOGE and their tech capabilities? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. Or if you're on YouTube, hey, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, I know very little about technology. And like you, it is very scary to know how much, to just really think about how much information the government has on all of us. I mean, I'm doing my taxes right now. It's concerning.
Yeah.
So maybe Charlie can help us answer some of those questions.
They've always had that information,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they have. And we never really thought about it. But now that we see Elon Musk's name in headlines and we hear DOGE and it sounds so scary, we wonder, what are they going to do with it? What could they do with it? And so we'll ask,
this different than the past?
Yeah, yeah.
Here's something that's not different. We're going to start the show with a trio of local news stories, as we always do, as we enjoy doing. Why don't you take the first one, Sherry?
Yeah, the community has rallied around the Turkish immigrant owners of a popular Haddon Township restaurant after their business was raided and they were detained by ICE on Tuesday. By Wednesday, neighbors had raised about $170,000 to support them. The couple is Jalal and Eminette. They have owned the Jersey Kebab for 5 years, and they are very known for helping the community. Their oldest son, Mohammed, said their family came to the United States from Turkey in 2008 on an R1 visa, which allows foreign nationals to temporarily do religious work in the U.S. At some point, that visa expired. They applied for a green card. They were denied. They appealed a couple of times, and it has been pending for quite some time. Their son says they don't have as much as a parking ticket, and they have committed no crimes. Take a listen to what he had to say.
I just cannot thank them enough for the support that they've given us, and I wish that we were judged amongst our peers instead of being judged by other judges who do not know us personally at all.
And that's him thanking the community for all of that support. By the way, even Congressman Donald Norcross expressed shock at the arrest of this couple, emphasizing that the Eminettes have been upstanding citizens. He's calling for immigration reform to protect families like theirs. By the way, one of the couple's sons is autistic, and they have a sign at the restaurant that says that they give free food to those who are in need, are homeless, or disabled. So they're very much beloved in Haddonfield.
Yeah, this is the rubber hitting the road on some of these campaign promises mm-hmm. from the Trump administration. And, of course, they promised to enact the largest mass deportation scheme in American history. They also promised to prioritize people who had committed violent crimes. And that does not seem to be what has happened here. And so when I talk about rubber hitting road, there are going to be more and more stories like this where the people who are arrested very publicly and detained do not match the description of the people that the Trump administration said they were going to target first.
Yeah.
How do voters react to that? How do communities react to that? Well, we're seeing one example here in South Jersey, and I think we will see more cases like this.
Yeah. And I can't say I was surprised that so many stepped up. I mean, they said that these folks are business people. They pay taxes. They've sought legal status. It's pending. These should not be the people that the Trump administration is going after. That's what the community support is basically saying.
Speaking of business.
Yeah.
Center City, Philadelphia, for many, many years, has been built around the business of offices.
Yes.
office space. Mm-hmm. That is how Center City has traditionally thrived. Of course, we know since the pandemic, office space is in lower demand, work from home, etc. So what should a city like Philadelphia do with all of that office space? One idea, mm-hmm. convert it to housing. One problem. It's expensive to do that. It's very expensive to do that. Office buildings are not laid out like residential buildings. And so Philadelphia is considering a big tax break, a 20-year property tax abatement. 20 years for companies who might take on these types of conversions in Center City. The Inquirer just reported on that this morning. Philadelphia's Tax Reform Commission is considering this proposal. It would only be in place for 5 years, so we'd have a five-year window to grab this 20-year tax break. But it's a pretty interesting idea. I would imagine there'll be some pushback.
Yeah, because we kind of need the money. The city needs the money. You know, Philadelphia is already likely to face a budget hit from federal funding cuts. And, you know, and I know that one of the commission members kind of said, oh, doing this could help with affordable housing. But because of the expensive nature of these conversions, most times you see them go towards high-end apartments, not affordable apartments, right?
Well, if you listened to our show yesterday, our guest said that that does help down market.
Yeah, because that does. Well,
it relieves pressure on other types of housing.
It could do that, but it's so expensive. It's so expensive. Other ideas, though, to sort of get people back into the city could be to cut the wage tax, cut the business taxes, make Philadelphia a more sexy place to want to set up shop.
A sexiness commission.
Yeah, put the leg out on
the city. Don't put me on that commission. I would not be helpful. No, but it's an interesting idea. And I think the idea behind it is that they want people to act now because they're worried there's going to be some sort of tipping point in Center City if those conversions don't happen soon, right? And so that's why it's a five-year window to potentially get the abatement that would last you 20 years because they're worried that the economic conditions for those conversions don't exist now, especially with the high interest rates and the potential tariffs coming. So like we need this incentive right now because if we don't make these conversions, Center City could slide the wrong direction. We'll see. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Third story. Here's a renovation that is happening for sure, we think.
Fingers crossed, our neighbor, Franklin Square, is getting some major upgrades.
Our neighbor.
Yeah.
Franklin Square is not a person, by the way. It's a place.
I know. It's a place. And it's right. It's very close to WHYY, our headquarters, right across the street near the Ben Franklin Bridge. By the way, the plan was announced yesterday. It'll cost $7.8 million. It'll take 18 months to complete. It'll be a total revamp of the playground and will include climbing boulders, zip lines.
Zip lines.
I know. Path for bikes and scooters. There will be an amphitheater. There will be a water mister for hot days.
Love a water mister.
Yeah, love a water mister. There will also be replacement of their public bathroom. The last one was built in 1976 for the bicentennial.
That's an old bathroom.
Old. Oh, and by the way, this has been one of my favorite places for many years. And part of it, since I started at WHYY during the summers, I like to go over there, relax, eat my lunch, you know, get maybe a milkshake or something from the Franklin Square and just hang out. They have the water fountain there. Mm-hmm. It's just a beautiful, beautiful little park.
So are you excited about this?
I am kind of excited. I mean, I'm not going to go ziplining, you know.
Oh, boo. Go ziplining.
I don't think I'm going to go ziplining on my break, but it seems like it. And they use the park for so many things. It's a beautiful little park.
I love parks. And I have a lot of opinions about parks.
Oh.
So I have come up with a list of these are my Philadelphia Park Oscars, okay?
Okay, I'm going to see if I agree. Let's go right. Poskers.
The Poskers.
Parkskers.
The Parkskers. All right. So I love parks.
Okay. And why do you love parks so much?
Because I have a little kid.
Yeah. And oh, yeah.
So in Philadelphia, the park with the best views.
Mm.
This is category number one. The park with the best views is, let's put that graphic up. That's Penn Treaty Park, right along the Delaware River.
Beautiful park. I live not too far from there.
You can see the Ben Franklin Bridge, the whole waterfront. I did consider some parks that had skyline views, but I feel like a skyline view is actually more common in Philadelphia, and a river view is harder to find, a great river view.
You know, I agree with you on this. This is a really great view.
That's the best view.
I can walk to this. This is great. Go ahead.
The park for the best people watching. Park number two is Clark Park in West Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah. They have the films.
They have the film screening. Yeah. I used to live across the street from this park. Every weekend there were people who did a drum circle and people who did LARPing. You know about LARPing?
What is LARPing?
Hard to describe. Live action role play. Basically people with fake swords and stuff, fake fighting each other.
Oh.
Great people watching in West Philly's Clark Park.
Okay.
Park number three. The best park for kids is Columbus Square Park in South Philadelphia. This is a little home bias. This is near my house. This place is always packed with kids and, crucially, other parents that you can talk to while your kids play.
And didn't they do something new with the playground?
They did.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think we did a whole show on, like, you know, playgrounds and how they help kids.
Yes.
You know, yeah, venture out and be braver.
Your park knowledge is vast. Congratulations.
Yes.
All right. Number four, the most underrated park in Philadelphia is Sister Cities Park. This park is just surrounded by traffic circles, okay?
Mm-hmm. I've seen it. Yeah, I've been there.
You have gone there?
I feel like no one goes to this park.
It's
right on the parkway, right?
It's so cool.
I've gotten coffee there.
It's like a little mini replica of the Wissahickon built into this pocket park. It's really cool. And finally, the best overall park.
I feel like you need a drum roll.
In Philadelphia. Are you ready?
Yes.
Is FDR Park in Deep South Philly.
Yeah.
I love this park. It's got everything. It's got nature.
Beautiful.
It's got fake lakes. It's got running trails. It's got a huge swing set, the biggest swing set in North America.
Nothing like a fake lake, though.
It's a great fake lake. It's like a series of fake lakes. And it's also just, FDR Park is like a melting pot.
Yeah.
Everyone from all over Philly goes to FDR Park. In my opinion, the best park in Philadelphia, maybe Franklin Square someday can aspire to be.
Well, with the zip lines, man, and the water misters, come on now.
There are no zip lines at FDR Park, I will say. Also, park yourself for today's episode of Studio 2, all about Doge and its tech access. We're talking with Atlantic writer Charlie Warzel all about it. On the other side of this break, give us a call, 888-477-9499. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manerich.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Some of the most alarming headlines about Elon Musk, Department of Government Efficiency, haven't come from reporters who cover government or politics. They've come from reporters who cover tech. Just today, the tech magazine Wired published a story called "The Doge Takeover is Worse Than You Think."
Sounds bad. And recently, our guest co-published a deep dive in The Atlantic titled "Doge Has God Mode Access to Government Data." It can be hard to understand all the details in these stories if you're a layperson like us, but the overall message is stark. Elon Musk and his surrogates are burrowing deep into complex IT systems with all sorts of ramifications for your privacy and the future of our government.
Now, Musk says all of this is about upgrades. At President Trump's first cabinet meeting yesterday, he gave a summary of Doge's efforts thus far. Take a listen.
I actually just call myself a humble tech support here because this is actually, as crazy as it sounds, that is almost a literal description of the work that the Doge team is doing, is helping fix the government computer systems. Many of these systems are extremely old. They don't communicate. There are a lot of mistakes in the systems. The software doesn't work.
And Musk says his engineers are going to make it all better. But is that really true? Or is this about access, control, and power? Here to help us make sense of Doge's tech capabilities and ambitions is Charlie Warzel. He is a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the newsletter Galaxy Brain. Charlie, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for coming on, Charlie. Before we start this conversation, we want to ask folks at home, what do you think about Doge potentially having access to your private data? Do you have questions about Doge and its tech capabilities? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org, or if you're on YouTube, drop your comment right there in the live chat.
And so, Charlie, we want to start this conversation by getting a clear understanding of what's actually happening. Could you tell us, what does Doge actually have access to?
That's a really complicated question, honestly. And that's part of the problem, I think. This is something a lot of us as reporters across different publications, but definitely at The Atlantic, have been trying to find out. And I think the big difficulty here is that the government is massive, right? And the government is broken up into a whole bunch of different agencies, and the systems can be interlinked, but they are not necessarily, they're not always talking to each other all the time. They all do different things, right? The IT systems for different agencies, and all the agencies do different things. So, you know, Treasury, for example, is processing financial payments. It has access to, you know, sensitive bank account information for every American who files their taxes. There are, for every agency, HR systems, which have a whole bunch of sensitive information. DOGE has gone into all of these different agencies over the last month or so since the inauguration, kind of in a haphazard way, right? They haven't entered every single agency yet, but when they have followed this pattern of basically coming in and saying, we need access, these engineers, these contract employees that either Elon Musk or DOGE has hired. They say, we need access to, you know, your IT systems, and we need, you know, full administrative, like the highest top tier, what we call, you know, God mode level privileges. You can see everything, right? That access is extremely, extremely rare in sort of pre-Trump era days to be granted to people, mm-hmm. right? You have to follow a whole bunch of procedures, and usually the only people who have access to the full system are people who actually have a really mundane job of like system administrator, right? Like their job is to just see what's going on, to make sure if there's something goes down, they can pop in and fix it, or to make sure no one's abusing it. And they are trusted to do that. They have the proper security clearances and training. This is a really long-winded answer, but what I'm trying to say is they're going into these agencies piecemeal, haphazardly, and we don't necessarily always know, right? And part of my reporting over the last month or so has been trying to figure out which agencies DOGE has gone into, but also which agencies they've succeeded in granting this permission. At the Treasury, for example, there is a real debate right now. The White House and the Treasury are saying, you know, they only have certain tiers of access to certain systems. They don't have the full administrative privileges to all that sensitive financial information. And yet there are people who have told reporters at Wired that there is sort of more broad-based level access. So last week or so, we published this story, which you guys referenced, and that story was really meaningful when we had the sources come to us, and they worked at USAID, and they were able, because they had knowledge of these systems, to give us an understanding of what DOGE got access to when they went in. And the short answer is absolutely everything.
Everything.
Wow. They got that tier of privilege inside every single system. So the way that they described this to me was, you know, not only did they have access to, you know, the systems that control and mete out the grant funding that goes out to, you know, all different places in the globally, all the different countries that request money. Over, I think, 2 years ago, that system processed close to $60 billion worth of funding. So they have access to that. They could, you know, change or modify those systems, change where the funding goes mm-hmm. through, who gets it, how, what they want to do. But then there's all kinds of, you know, sort of more mundane information inside that system. You know, USAID has tens of thousands of employees, and there is access to the full HR systems. So there's a lot of reputational data there. Yes, there's their social security numbers, there's potentially bank information for payroll, but there's also, you know, say we all work there at USAID together, and 4 years ago, I filed an HR complaint against the two of you. Turns out you were cleared of no wrongdoing. I was incorrect. That information stays in a file, right? Yeah. And that information, if it comes out, could be used without the proper context against somebody reputationally if it gets leaked. That's very sensitive stuff. So anyway, that's the sort of the long and short of mm-hmm. we don't know what exactly they have information, they have access to in a high level sense. But in the circumstances like USAID where we know that they have access to everything in an unprecedented fashion.
So let's talk about the unprecedented part mm-hmm. of this, right? Because we do have commenters kind of pushing back, being like, well, how is this different than the past? Wesley says they've had access since Obama. Y'all only care now because y'all hate Trump. Bryant says everybody has it. Data breaches, companies selling info. Big Brother has always been watching. You say that some of this access has been granted to people who haven't gone through the normal protocols. Is that the only difference, the fact that they haven't gone through the training and the protocols? Or is there something else that distinguishes this type of coordinated access centralized in like one place, one agency? It's not really agency, but one sort of administrative body like DOGE.
Well, the first thing I would say to one of the commenters who mentioned this, you know, oh, we had access since Obama. People have had access far before Barack Obama. I mean, this is not a partisan thing. And what I would say to that is that a lot of people who I've spoken with who have been ringing the alarm bell on this, they're Republicans. By you know, like, they're not people who are motivated by a sense of that there are people in the government who are actually in favor of a Department of Government Efficiency. But because they work in the computer and IT space, they understand how these systems have been controlled, why they've been controlled, what all of these, you know, procedures and security procedures are in place for. And they're watching unelected officials, not confirmed by Congress, not elected by the United States government. In one case, this organization is pretty much unofficially overseen by the richest man in the world, who has billions of dollars in government contracts and a absolute slew of conflicts of interest in terms of having potential access to this data. I mean, Elon Musk runs Tesla, he runs SpaceX, he runs a lot of other small companies, he runs X, formerly Twitter. And having access to all this government data gives you access to contracts, national security, you know, implications are very large in all of that, but also just competitive and corruption implications here. You can see where money is going. You can see who's getting money. You can undercut bids to other contractors to make sure that, you know, they don't get their contracts. And that's, you know, that's an anti-competitive situation there and a massive potential conflict of interest. Maybe you don't care about that. But in terms of the second part of this, what is unprecedented? In the federal government IT infrastructure, I've talked to probably 60, 70 IT workers over the last month on this. This information is so sensitive, like all data, because once it leaves a system, there's nothing that you can do. You cannot recoup it. You cannot unring the bell as somebody.
It's out there, it's out there.
Yeah.
It's out there and it's out there. And a lot of this information is different than, you know, information that comes from even, you know, your bank or Equifax or something like that. There's a lot of national security information, you know, at some of these different agencies. There are covert people in the field whose identities are protected, right? There are national security secrets of all kinds embedded in all of this, right?
But in the past, someone always had access to this stuff, right? Like someone always could have conceivably viewed this, manipulated it, given it to a foreign adversary. Is there something different other than the fact that we don't trust Elon Musk and his particular surrogates? Like, are they doing something different other than the fact that there's reason not to trust them with the information specifically?
One source I spoke with has a top secret security clearance, and they try to get access to one of these systems. So let's just use a government agency and say that there are 15 different IT computer systems. They were trying to access one of them. They've been working in the government for 25 years, and they have a top secret security clearance. And it took them 9 months and a series of about 15 or 16 interviews with different people up the chain. Now, you can make a case, as I'm sure Elon Musk would if he was sitting across from me, that this is inefficient. But some of that information had access to secrets about, covert representatives across the world, who, if they were exposed, you know, lives are in danger and potentially there are national security implications. DOGE representatives got access to this system in 36 hours.
Wow!
Right, these are people. Some of these people are under 30 years old, which is fine. I'm not trying to be ageist here, but they don't have many years of government experience. Yeah. In fact, they have no government experience. They don't know.
They say that's the calling card, though, right?
Yeah.
They don't.
Right. But also at the same time, I think if you've ever been in an organization, there is institutional knowledge that is actually valuable, I would say. You can certainly get, you know, lost in the sauce and can, you know, overcomplicate things and make needless bureaucracy. I think everyone would agree that there's inefficiency in the government. I would also argue that, as some of these sources have told me, you need to understand sometimes what you're seeing. Yeah. And not only because you can't be trusted with the information, but sometimes you can go into these systems and you can accidentally change something. And it's not very easy to fix that. And sometimes those systems help the country run on time, right? Like you can theoretically mess around in some of this really old code, some of these systems that frankly do need to be updated. You can mess around with that and veterans in Idaho no longer get their prescriptions processed. Yeah. So, you know, what happens there? Like the what I have learned in all this reporting is that the government serves a lot of very unsexy functions and does a lot of things in a kind of convoluted way that could be made more efficient. But in order to do that, you need to really understand these systems. You need to understand where the inefficiencies are. You need to be really doing a lot of the difficult work of knowing what you're looking at.
Yeah.
And that takes time. And that is not something that we have seen from all of the reporting that we've done and that other people have done. It seems very much like a let's rip the, you know, the wires out of the mainframe because, you know, we'll see what ends up happening there.
Yeah. I want to read this email from Chuck, who says the government and country are in very serious financial distress. Corruption and secret spending have been a concern for anyone with pragmatic common sense for decades. DOGE needs to happen, and the aggressive resistance to it demonstrates how embedded pork spending, obscure foreign program spending, and a whole lot more we have in here from Chuck. And so I want you to sort of lay out their arguments, because you said there's God mode in some places. There's read-only mode in other places. We don't know what levels of access DOGE has in these various agencies, but I want you to lay out, what is the argument for why DOGE, Elon Musk, why do they need that top-level access, and what do they say they're going to do with it?
Well, you know, that has not necessarily been articulated in a full way. That's also part of this, right? People who are working in the government, and I'm not just talking about, you know, IT people, people who I've talked to inside these agencies are saying one of the issues is there's not really been a lot of good communication. A lot of people, including myself, have remarked on how the, you know, the DOGE, we'll call it an incursion into the federal government, has a lot of like parallels to Elon Musk going inside of Twitter, right, when he purchased it. And a lot of that sort of organizational chaos, right? A lot of sending an email saying you've got 30 minutes to justify your job or you're fired, and then retracting that email. You know, there was this fork in the road email that was sent out to, you know, millions of government employees, giving these, you know, these options for you to, you know, get severance and resign from your job. And then it turns out, you know, some of those things were retracted. It turns out they couldn't do it. There's this kind of, again, haphazard, improvised nature to this, that where it's not very clear what's going on, right? What they would say, I'm sure, based off of a lot of this reporting, is what they want to do is have full audit access to every single process, every single piece of data, every bit of information in the government, so that they can understand what is going on and also, you know, find ways to shave down efficiencies, find ways to cut costs, to cut spending. And one of the ways in which they really want to do this is to use AI tools to analyze and find these inefficiencies. And, you know, I think that there are reasons that one could, you know, believe this, right? And one could say, okay, this is what I've seen a lot of people in favor of this, like, let's use the highest, you know, levels of technology to scan for inefficiencies and things like that. Mm-hmm. There is also a real security issue with funneling all this information into large language models. Again, because of this idea that once it's in these things, you cannot get it out. You can also port it over elsewhere, right? There's also, you know, there's issues with auditing those types of models. Government procurement, which is, you know, the use of getting outside technology to make the government better in some way, a different tool, a different service that they pay for and hire, is a really complex and difficult process, very painstaking, in part because, you know, there's so much, the stakes are so high in all of this to make sure that our information is protected. You know, speaking to, again, these national security concerns, speaking to this idea, I think someone said something about, you know, adversaries, spies, people like that getting access to this information. You can have, and I it's possible that this has happened before, right? An adversary or spy for another country, you know, gains access to a government agency through, you know, standard old employment, rising up through the ranks, or a government employee at an agency is, you know, is converted into an asset.
Old-fashioned spy work, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Old-fashioned spy work, right? That person would ostensibly have access to maybe one of these systems, if they're lucky.
Not all of them.
What happens in this sense when we port all of the federal government's data and information, including that national security information, into a large language model, and it is hacked because it's not properly securitized by China or something like that? And then they have access to absolutely everything.
And Charlie, I got to ask you, there was reasons why these agencies and their data had been separated. What does it mean when you feed it all into one? Can you talk about some of the vulnerabilities we now have when you have one? And I think you kind of talked about this, but I don't think we really, really have a clear understanding of what vulnerabilities exist when one entity has access to everything.
I think we really don't fully know, right? We don't know what the sum total of that is. We can make a lot of, you know, conjectures and things like that. But this is part of dealing with an unprecedented situation. Is we don't know what is possible. We do know, however, that you know, there's been some reporting that one of these young engineers who works for DOGE, you know, used to work for a hacking consortium that at one point was involved with, you know, distributing, you know, pornographic materials and things like that among minors. It was like very kind of unsavory people. And this coder, this engineer, this hacker was kicked out of that group because he was leaking secrets from the hacking collective, and also he was they had said a fraud of an engineer. He was not actually good at the job of the hacking, so he was leaking secrets and inept. That person had access at some point to sensitive federal government information. So, you know, you have to ask, okay, let's say nothing happened there, right? And it, you know, there's no proof that anything has happened in that sense. That's just an example of the type of vulnerability. This is why you go through that extremely strenuous process of you know, background checks and understanding, because, you know, people who get to these levels of security clearance,
Warzel, but we'll put a pin in that thought. Mm-hmm. Also want to talk to you about some of those hypotheticals, what could possibly happen if access is granted broadly to DOGE, what could be done, positive and negative, with all of that information. Hey, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Studio2@WHYY.org is the email address. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about DOGE's God mode access to federal agencies and what it means for millions of Americans. With us is Charlie Warzel, staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the newsletter Galaxy Brain. And I want to invite you at home and watching on YouTube to join us in the conversation. Avi, give out the question and the number again.
Question is, what do you think about Doge potentially having access to your private data? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, or leave a comment in the YouTube chat. Let me read a couple of them. Atlanta on YouTube says, I think they should be stopped as soon as possible and removed from what they're getting their grubby fingers into. Did anyone bother vetting these people? Background, security, etc. Hope says, we need access to his private data. Mm. I think the his there is Elon Musk. Okay. So, Charlie Warzel, I think a lot of people are looking at this through a personal lens, and they're worried about their own personal data. So, in a scenario where Doge has access to just about everything, what would they have access to about the average American? And then what could potentially be done with that information?
Yeah, I think the way to think about it, because there's no easy laundry list, right? And also, I'm not in the government, so I don't have full, you know, I can't show you necessarily the receipts. But I think a way to think about this, as I have, is try to think about your interactions with the government in your life, right? And think about each agency that you interact with, right? Think about the, you know, if you ever fly, right? And then think about the FAA and think about the information they have, you know, tracking your movements across the country. You know, think about TSA, think about those types of things. Think about the Treasury and think about you filing your taxes and think about your bank account and your routing number. Think about, you know, your social security number is the thing that kind of comes up all the time, right?
Yeah.
But that is... you give your social security number to a lot of things, and there's a lot of data breaches. Equifax breached the data of hundreds of millions of Americans a couple of years ago. There are issues with that, obviously, but that's sort of probably the most prosaic piece of information. You know, I think, again, bank accounts, routing numbers, someone I spoke to who's really worried about this, you know, said that they don't think that banks are even thinking very strongly about, you know, the fact that all of this information could potentially be exposed. You know, when there are big hacks of government information, the information is relatively, you know, prosaic. But when you think about this bigger, you know, level, the higher stakes of this. So then, you know, go through the Department of Transportation, think about your driver's license, all your information, all of your toll receipts, all of that. I mean, I just keep on extrapolating through all of these departments.
Quick
right?
follow-up.
Think about, yeah, go
Quick
ahead.
Quick follow-up on that. Could someone conceivably manipulate that data? Like, make it look like I committed tax fraud when I didn't?
Technically, yes. This is why some of these, again, I want to be very clear, there is not evidence of this mm-hmm. at the moment. So I think it's wrong for people to really like freak out and think that this has happened. But I will say I had a government IT source who understands these systems really well saying that they put a freeze on all of their credit scores.
Yeah.
Because they do not trust that this information could not be changed or manipulated. I think, you know, a lot of government employees are worried because they, you know, in some of these circumstances where they have the full administrative access, which is you can manipulate that data if you want, they're worried that someone's going to go in and in the name of efficiency, change all of their salaries without any going through any official channels, right? Just change a 5 to a 0 or whatever. That is within the realm of technical capability. They could do that. There is no evidence that that has happened. I want to be incredibly clear, but this is part of the concern. One source told me that one of the biggest fears in IT with getting this, it's, you know, called super administrative access, what I refer to as God mode.
Yeah.
One of the fears with that is once you go into that, if you have that highest tier of access, you can do multiple things. You can do something called creating a backdoor, which is basically creating an opening inside the system for people who don't have to go through the login credential, you know, system mm-hmm. normally. Theoretically, you could invite anyone you want, right? And then the other concern is you can do things without being traced.
Yeah.
Without
make changes audited. And so, no one can tell that you made the
and
changes.
So we might not Correct. Even know what yeah. they did. I want to just encourage our listeners to call in. What do you think about Doge having access to your private data? The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your question or comment in the chat. We have a caller, Mary from Philadelphia, says she's concerned. Mary, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that this is all completely outrageous. And something has to be done about it, like yesterday. Where is Congress in all this? I can't believe they can't do anything about it, or at least take the whole matter to court and stop it in its tracks until it can get to the Supreme Court. This is something we really have to fight. I can envision a situation where someone gets hold of my Social Security number and my bank account and uses it to make outrageous fake purchases or enter into contracts that would involve me, create debt in my name. I'm a senior citizen. Almost my whole income is my Social Security check. What would I do if someone used my name, Social Security number, bank account number, and created all manner of debt in my name and then skipped out on it?
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you. Do you have anything else to add, Mary? Oh, Mary's gone. Mary's gone. That's Mary from Philadelphia. She raises a lot of concerns, Charlie. And she also asked the question, can this be stopped? We have all kinds of privacy laws. We have all sorts of confidentiality requirements when it comes to federal data. Is there any way to stop this or put some more protocols or security measures in place to protect the data of Americans?
I mean, again, we're in unprecedented territory, right? I think that's the issue here because, you know, these systems, a lot of the laws, a lot of the procedures, a lot of the whatever, protect people from getting access. Once you've been given access, it's very difficult. And technically, you know, one can make a case, and people are, and there are lawsuits here that are trying to stop some of this incursion and sort of freeze, right, what's happening right now. Some of those have been more successful than others, but there is there are challenges being mounted to people trying to access this data. You know, the issue with all of this and the reason why I keep tossing the term unprecedented around is technically these are government contractors, right? Mm-hmm. If a person loyal to Donald Trump is installed as the chief information officer of one of these agencies or the head of one of these agencies appointed by Donald Trump and confirmed by Congress, say, if they grant access to a 22-year-old coding employee who's a contractor, there's nothing you can really do because those are going through the official channels, so to speak. But there are lawsuits, there are things like that. I would just counsel this caller not to maybe worry quite as much about the individual, right? I know that we are talking about Doge having access to your data, and I think that the outrage is right? Yeah. I think one should
on
be outraged
right? mm-hmm.
on principle yeah. having access to this data. What I would be, the example that I'm going to use is actually from today. The Washington Post just reported this, but yesterday Elon Musk said in a cabinet meeting that, you know, they're moving fast and they've made a few mistakes. They accidentally, you know, got rid of funding for Ebola prevention,
yep.
right?
And they replaced
and
it.
Don't worry, they restored it. The Washington Post reported this morning that they have not restored it. And in fact, the programs are cut, they're destroyed, and the money is gone now. And that is something, you know, Ebola is obviously a very serious illness.
It is.
It's also U.S. aid, in the sense, is a part of America's soft power around the world, right? Providing aid to people in need is a thing that, you know, helps American standing, actually is, you know, can bolster our national security interests like that, but also make it so that we don't have, you know, a deadly outbreak of disease that can then spread and come to our shores. This is a really good example of a bunch of people who are sort of new to this, you know, the government processes, going into systems that maybe they don't quite
they
yet
don't understand,
understand or moving too quickly with this mm-hmm. information. Mm-hmm. And some of that information, you know, money now is data, right? It's information. If you change and reallocate the funds, it's very difficult to claw that back. Somebody in the government told me once that when the government shuts down, right, just as it does when there's not, you know, a budget
debt ceiling,
that gets funded,
all that, yeah.
Correct. when that happens, they said it usually takes, for every week the government is shut down, it's a month of backlog to, because the government moves so slowly,
yeah.
to get all the systems back in place, to get all the people back into place.
Right. So once you break it, it's very hard to put back together.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's how I would think about this.
Yeah, let me bring in a caller now. Mm-hmm. This is Eric from Exton. Eric, you're on Studio 2. Getting close to the end of the hour here. Eric, what is your question or comment?
Yeah, I don't have a concern about DOGE. I think it's absolutely necessary when you think about the existential threat of our country being $36 trillion in debt, and to watch a bunch of, you know, 60, 70, and 80-year-old politicians, you know, wringing their hands about, you know, 19-year-olds taking a look at, you know, our financial systems, I think is pretty rich when those same politicians are going to leave those 19-year-olds with $36 trillion in debt. And of course, there should be safeguards, but I know McKinsey's in there a lot of times with government contracts, and they're looking at things and trying to see, you know, how money is spent. And of course, there's common sense things that need to be looked at, and if they're doing stuff like that, yeah, we should take a step and make sure it's being done correctly. But you know, all these programs are just, you know, I just can't believe we're spending things on like plays and comic books when we're $36 trillion in debt. It's just mind-boggling. I know that's Congress, but Congress doesn't seem to want.
So you're saying this is a risk worth taking, Eric. Let these guys in there do whatever they do, mm-hmm. and you're willing to live with the consequences.
I agree. I mean, I think it's a much higher risk than having some prescriptions. My father gets his prescriptions from the VA. I understand all that, but you know, if that breaks for a week or two or a month, that's bad. But it's far worse as a country. You know,
what about forever?
Dollars just in interest. Yeah, just $1 trillion in interest. Think what you could do with that money if we didn't have to pay interest mm-hmm. on it. And we're just adding.
I want to make sure Charlie Wardzell has a chance to respond to that, because that does capture the tenor mm-hmm. of a lot of the pushback, right? Like this, what people are coming at this from the perspective of, it's broken, so why not take a risk to try to fix it? Now, the it there shifts around a little bit, but a lot of people have that mindset going in. What would you say back to that caller, Charlie Wardzell?
It's his opinion. I understand that. I think that it's illustrative of the fact of the reason why they're there, right? Because as you said, this is an opinion that is shared widely. I think again the concern that a lot of people have, right? I think a big one is national security. I also think another one is this idea of people not understanding the complex systems that they're mm-hmm. dealing with, and the potential for risk being very large. You know, he mentioned his father getting VA prescriptions. You know, if that data is somehow deleted, messed with, and it's, you know, it's possible that it's not just going to be a week. It could be months, or it could be a system in which, you know, that person is going to have to go through a series of, you know, multiple appointments and rechecks to, you know, and rediagnoses and, you know, an administrative process that is, you know, very painful, and they're not getting the care they deserve. And I think that what people are really worried about here, and I understand why it seems like, again, like it's, oh, the bureaucracy is protecting itself.
Yep.
And I know that people have a very dim opinion of the government, but I think what I have learned in this process is that mm-hmm. a lot of the people who maintain these systems, who do this sort of work, it's very thankless work. They do it because they really care about providing things to people. They really care about the trains, quote unquote, running on time. And I think that they are just so concerned that the way in which this process is happening, I don't think they actually, I think they work in the government, they know it's inefficient.
Yeah.
But I think they are so worried because they know how easy it is to bungle these systems, to throw a wrench in them.
They're more worried with the process than the goal. They're more worried with the process than goal is what I hear you saying. Like some of them, you said some of them, a lot of the people talking to you are Republicans who might in principle agree with what a lot of what Eric said, but they're also in these systems and they feel like, hey, this is not the way to fix them. That's the basic what I'm hearing from you.
I think the way to think about it would be if you have worked your job for a long time and you understand what you're doing, whatever the job is, right? And someone comes in without any understanding of what that is and says, you know, say, you know, you're a carpenter.
Right.
And they say, well, I sell refrigerators and I'm damn good at doing that. And so I'm going to show you how to, you know, be a carpenter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I don't know is probably a decent enough place to leave it. Charlie Worzel, staff writer at The Atlantic, author of the newsletter Galaxy Brain. I kind of feel like there's a whole galaxy going on in my brain right now.
And
I'm trying to sort through it, but thanks for helping
us.
That's probably how a lot of your conversations go. Yes. Thanks so much for helping us start down the path. Charlie Worzel, appreciate the time.
Yeah, take care.
Yeah, and thank you for everybody who wrote in and commented. We got so many, and for our callers today. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer. Thanks to Al Banks and Tina Calliquet. And thanks to our executive producer, Kevin McCrory, and Joan Isabella, WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you next week.